Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your co-host, Paul David.
I'm Rebecca Hedman.
And I'm William Gadsby Pete. And if you're listening in, please don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Really, really helps us, makes a huge difference to the listenership and the great guests that we can get on. On today's pod, we are taking a deep dive into a topic that most unites us as a team, one of our shared loves, food, or more specifically, food tech. It's a bit of an interesting industry. It's not one that you would normally associate with being quite tech-led, but there's some very cool stuff happening in the space, and so we wanted to do a bit of a spotlight on a lot of that. So we'll be looking at the origins and covering just how the tech revolution is changing the way that we sort of grow, harvest, consume, and basically do everything with food, some sustainability, and some food safety.
Today, we'll also be joined by the CEO of FreshCheck, Alex Bond, a bit later in the show, who will discuss how FreshCheck is pioneering food hygiene standards. But before that, let's get to the first topic of today's show. So today, we're going to jump into the origins of food and tech. For many of our listeners, food tech was first introduced as a subject in high school. And for old heads like me, those days are long gone. So since then, there's been an expansion in the true intersection of food and technology. Over the years, technology has dramatically altered how we produce, find, and receive our food. God bless Deliveroo. I really need someone to take that app away from me whenever I get stoned, but here we are. Today, we're going to talk about some of the early factors that have led to the integration of technology in the food industry and how this has evolved over the years. Let's talk about, you know, some of the early developments that led to the integration of technology in the food industry and how it's evolved over time.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because if you think about it, in many ways, this is almost like the OG focus of tech. For so long, the only thing you invented was ways to make more food and harvest food more effectively. I'm obviously talking about like the pre sort of industrial revolution era. But then increasingly what we've seen, especially over the last 40 or 50 years, is increased focus on food and the food tech space is just the realization of like, oh shit, there are 7.5 billion people in the world right now. You know, how do we feed them? There's almost been a renewed interest, certainly the last 10, 20 years of like, oh, this is a really, really important thing. And we probably can't carry on as we have been, you know, just sort of using old methods and thinking that it's all fine, you know, like that we've seen what happened in Ukraine. Ukraine is responsible for like a third of the world's wheat, and it doesn't have any modern practices for growing that wheat. It's, you know, it's all old school farms. You wouldn't look out of place in the Victorian era. So I think there's a maybe for almost the last, you know, the 1900s to the sort of 1980s, no one really cared about this anymore, but suddenly it does seem to be back in vogue and back with a vengeance as people have realized, oh, these questions are actually really, really important. And we don't want to be in a sort of global economy where one war can make quite a significant amount of some poorer countries have a real risk of starving because they were importing a ton of grain. There must be a better way.
This is more recent, but we've seen over the last maybe like 50 years, give or take, we're importing in foods from other countries. And I think that that has definitely led to the progression of technology in food, because obviously when you are bringing in certain types of goods from different countries, especially if it's a sort of a long haul destination, you have to look at the way that you are harvesting those foods, the way that you are transporting those foods, and the way that you are actually storing those foods. So I think that maybe in like the 1900s or pre that, when we were actually just eating what we grew locally, and there is some more emphasis on that now. I mean, like, for example, my granddad has a garden and he grows potatoes, tomatoes, like spinach, courgettes. So a lot of those kind of vegetables that I eat actually come from my granddad's garden. And we're seeing a lot of people buying into that again. But I think for the majority, they are eating foods that have come in internationally. So I think that that has definitely pushed the integration of technology in the food industry. So that would be one of my key things that I think has made a huge impact as well.
Yeah, I think it's important too when we talk about food tech to like kind of ground ourselves a little bit and what the research is showing, and like ask ourselves, are recent food tech innovations helping to solve like some core problems around food insecurity, food waste, the health of the food that we see? There's this report from the Food Standards Agency that looks at how, you know, 1 in 4 people in England, Wales, Northern Ireland are food insecure, which is the highest level since they began tracking it in 2020. So as we're looking at these food tech innovations, how are they addressing this issue by I don't know, helping people, you know, have local gardens, as you mentioned, Rebecca, or getting people just access to, you know, high quality vegetables and things like that. And we know that, you know, from this research that food prices are the top, you know, food related concern. You open the Guardian, you see people, you know, going on about like the cost of eggs and the cost of milk and stuff in the UK, which actually in comparison to what I've seen in the States are actually relatively low cost. But other concerns about food waste, quality of food, the amount of food packaging, I know that's been a big one. We've seen a lot of innovation around food packaging, I think, as like consumers get more educated and basically demand from companies more streamlined eco packaging as well.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of key in where a lot of the food tech that's popped up over the last 10, 20 years has come from, is we had this sort of period of incredible plenty where there weren't that many people on the planet. Capitalism was just like at its absolute on steroids peak, where, you know, no one gave a shit about the quality of food, its sustainability, its carbon footprint. It was just like, hey, this burger costs 50p or 50 cents. Like, do you want to buy it? Yeah, sure. And then, yeah, as we've sort of had an increase in the world population and also an increase in the demand of that population for quality, and like, you know, nutritionists just explaining that like you can't eat crap bread meat every single day, we're starting to realize like, oh, there's actually quite significant problems here that you probably do need to solve via tech, where you can track the carbon footprint, the sustainability, the fair trade nature, whether or not it's using the right packaging. And yeah, there's sort of a two-pronged attack that has led to a lot of this innovation of needing to reduce food waste, of like, we don't have enough food to go around, and it's actually quite difficult to grow, give access to everyone to quality food that isn't, you know, just crap and you know, is genuinely good for them.
One interesting avenue to talk about this too is like, talk about, you know, food production processes. And I think there's a big concern that like COVID started from sort of inadequate food production processes and what was being done with animals in the food market. And so, you know, I think it's important to like kind of look at the way that like automation and robotics in particular are finding their way into food tech. I thought this was a really interesting stat from the Forbes piece that we read about the number of robots in the European food industry is well over 30,000, while the number of robots per employee per 10,000 employees rose from 62 in 2013 to 84 in 2017. So like, to that question of like, are people being automated out of their jobs, and what's the role of, you know, automation in the food tech industry? I think it's really interesting to see like there's a physical increase in the number of robots that folks in the food production industry have to engage with. In some cases, they're taking up like core skills and core duties that person otherwise would be doing. And just looking at robot density, which is not something I'd thought about in the context of food production, Germany obviously being the largest market, but there's other countries like Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, and Italy that have relatively high robot density in the food production market as well. So I think that's like a fascinating angle into an intersection of food tech, AI, automation, things like that.
We should have robots per 10,000 employees as a metric that we track on our website at all times, and like red flags of like, oh God, we've gone past 1,000 robots for every 10,000 employees. We're at a critical juncture, that like a doomsday clock. Let's do that.
It's a good question. Like, what is an appropriate amount of robots per employee? I mean, so many factors. That's, yeah.
Yeah, one each, like a robot and a human companion, or?
But I mean, think about how many like tools you use that are, you know, robot. Like, I mean, I think in this case, they're talking about physical robots that have motion and like move things and stuff like that, obviously. But, you know, if you were to place a robot with like any digital tool or something like that.
And Alex Bond had a very interesting point about this in our interview later, where he's like, 100%, there are stuff that can do, but a lot of those robots, it's like logistics robots, it's carrying stuff. They tried to create a robot that could pick strawberries, and they just absolutely couldn't do it. It completely failed as a project because it wasn't possible for the robot to look at the strawberry and decide whether it's ripe or not. And like, actually, that's an incredibly difficult thing to solve through robotics. So I do think that like the and you know, we'll get there, but like for this industry in particular, like some of the most exciting stuff I've seen has been, yeah, we're using that sort of foundation of automation and robotics, but there's still a huge human element. One of the things you often see talk about is like vertical farming. The problem with farmland is you have to have a huge swathe of land that is very fertile to grow, which is a pretty fucking labor intensive thing to do, by the way. There's no real financial incentive to the growers because the market has got used to cheap food that almost every farmer, like in almost every country, is propped up by its government through subsidies and incentives, or they just go bust in a really not unpleasant way. It's a very inefficient way of doing it. It takes up a huge amount of space. All the uproar we have in the UK every time you talk about building on the green belt and shit like that, and that's not even farmland. It's just like countryside that people like. So vertical farming is an alternative to this, where you essentially build a skyscraper where every floor of it is a floor of a farm. And a large part of the growing of all the stuff in there is done through automated light cycles, you know, automated filtration, nutrients. You know, if anyone's ever grown weed, I haven't, you know, but for a friend of a friend, I have seen someone grow quite a lot of weed once when I was at university, and they were explaining the hydroponics to me, and it is fascinating stuff. And it's basically just that, but like 40 stories high, where, you know, you have exactly the right pH for the soil, you have exactly the right amount of light, you have exactly the right amount of everything, and you can very quickly end up with 10 of these skyscrapers in a city that can feed a city. So I think that's some of the coolest potential for the future. And I do think, as you know, we hit the 9 billion, 12 billion human being mark, it is just going to require stuff like that to feed such an insanely large amount of people.
Meanwhile, my home country is throwing away 40% of its food every single year. So like whatever we can do to reduce that number and utilize the extra food, I think becomes critical. On the positive side, though, I did see in this piece that NASA has figured out a way to 3D print pizza in space, which is everything that makes my heart happy. It's like NASA, it's space, it's pizza. It's just like, yeah. And then 3D printing is amazing. So yeah, apparently there's a startup called BHEX that came out of Silicon Valley that has harnessed that tech and has allowed them to deliver edible, cheesy, delicious pizza that can be pre-programmed by robot. To be fair, like, could we use technology like that that has like this edge use case to like, let's roll that out? And I think now, granted, this there's the profit motive, right? They're going to roll this out to the friggin' theme parks and malls and sports arenas and stuff like that. But like, could we deliver this kind of technology to places where there actually is, you know, a need for food, or for, you know, some like, could they 3D print more nutritious food than pizza or something like that? I think maybe yes. Pizza arguably has, you know, a lot of vegetables and, you know, five a day in there. But I think it's really interesting to look at some of these applications and say, okay, this is cool, this is an edge case, but could it actually be used to solve some of these core problems in terms of food insecurity and food waste? So we'll see.
I think there are people looking at those solutions as well, Paul, because I saw, to your point about 40% of America's food being thrown away, there's an app called Copiar which uses extensive food waste reduction dashboard to actually connect business with surplus food to local shelters, after school programs and other nonprofit organizations. And there's actually another app like that in the UK called Food to Go, which I'm signed up to. And basically at the end of the day, they will tell you in your local area, like if Greg's has extra food left over, or Starbucks, or whatever kind of food restaurant or takeaway bakery, etc. And I think apps like that are really positive and useful, and I think a lot of consumers are now really invested in supporting businesses and apps that actually connect you with these kinds of things. So I think on the positive side, it is inspiring that kind of tech development and consumers who align with that, because I think we all do it. We align with brands and businesses that follow our beliefs. So I think there's a lot of room for that development to actually spread over. And it's good to see apps like Copiar and Food to Go, the one that I've got here in the UK, actually trying to solve or kind of reduce the waste problem.
Yeah, there's another one called Too Good to Go in the UK.
I think that's what it's called, Too Good, not Food to Go.
No, I'm like, and again, it's just, this is the thing. You realize like the food industry has actually just been like pretty inefficient and silly for quite some time. Like, you know, and it really is as simple as like, hey, every restaurant at the end of each and food chain at the end of the day always has product that they have to throw away. Some of them have donate those to food shelters, and that's great, but there's only so much those food shelters can take, so that, again, they've got to give all of that food away in a single day, otherwise it's out of date and they can't give it even to those in need. So why not just connect an app that, and I use that app almost every other day. Like, you know, you're on the way home, you're like, oh sweet, I can go grab £5 worth of prep but get like £20 worth of sandwiches. Like, you know, it's such an easy, simple fix to a problem that everyone's known about for like 30 years. So yeah, I do think there is a lot of positive in terms of like what tech can do when applied to some of these problems.
Yeah, I think the drone stuff is super interesting, and I never even heard the term precision agriculture, but the idea that, like, you know, we could leverage GPS tracking systems and satellite imagery for like monitoring crop yields and soil levels and weather patterns. I got a buddy works over at an outfit called Arable. That's a precision agriculture startup out of the Bay Area, and they're doing some really interesting stuff. The idea that like these drones can locate and identify disease and damage crops and sort of tend to them more quickly than a food worker can. And obviously, again, to the point of not trying to eliminate everyone's job, I think, you know, the robots, they don't eliminate the need for food workers, but they do help them be more efficient with their work. And when you take that into account with, like, I saw some research about the ways that climate change and increased heat are impacting childbearing food workers who are out in the fields, and how it's putting a lot of pressure on babies and things like that, and it's causing birth defects and things like that. I think, you know, we're going to need to like have these sort of climate adaptive solutions like precision agriculture driven by drones that allow food workers to spend less time in hot fields and be able to focus their work a bit more and maybe sit in the shade longer, because it's already having a real impact on you know, childbearing and the health of our race. So I think solutions like this are really positive and really hopeful for the future.
I think it's one of those things where like it might replace some jobs, but I don't think it's jobs that like people will miss. And again, as long as our society offers alternative routes for those folk to be employed in, you know, do you really care if we're not using awful, cheap, exploitative migrant labor to pick our food from our fields, and instead it's a robot and we offer those people good jobs? Like, no, I think that's objectively a better society to live in.
Yeah, I think about like the opportunities it opens up too. So for this one, I want to give a shout out to Arit, A-E-R-I-T, out of Stockholm. It's arit.co. They're doing some really interesting stuff when it comes to drone delivery for grocery store chains in Sweden, in the greater Stockholm area. Obviously that, you know, to some extent takes away the job of like an Ocado or sort of delivery driver, but also it opens up a ton of jobs in terms of those people can become drone pilots. Those people then can become sort of like surveyors or mappers and kind of map the terrain and things like that. They can become, you know, computer scientists and things like that. Now, that I know that's like oftentimes a leap. Someone arrives to a country, they've got to get trained up. But I think these are the things that we need private industry and government to invest in training programs, and not just say, hey, we're going to cull an entire workforce. We're actually going to train folks up to be the new face of this workforce that is going to include a lot more automation, a lot more robotics. I think that's kind of the direction that we want to see things go. But again, it's going to be a question of investment from private industry, from the government into, you know, how do we create work for the humans in this new tech landscape when it comes to, you know, things like drone delivery for groceries and food.
Again, just to give an idea of like, you know, it's not a small thing. People talk about like, you know, food delivery and stuff, like 50% of adults state that takeout and delivery services are essential. It really is ingrained as a fundamental part of our sort of day-to-day. So if you can make these industries more efficient and better, it really does affect a huge amount of people at once. It's not small, niche little groups. It's most adults. Taking us into the second topic of the pod, which is more looking at like the actual kitchen itself. We sort of already covered food delivery, but this is more kind of the smart kitchen and, you know, some of the more consumer facing stuff. This is more the stuff that on it might make an impact on our day to day lives in terms of buying stuff and having it in the kitchen. There's a lot of cool stuff we've seen in the kitchen. Recent survey saw that 51% of Brits wish they had innovative technology as part of the kitchen appliances in their home. I recently purchased a thermometer that I put in meat, and then it tells me on my phone it's like when it's ready to be taken off the barbecue, which it's called the Thermom Meat, spelled M-E-A-T. Genius. Incredible marketing. I want us to get them as a client one day. So that's the coolest bit of kitchen tech I've had as a gadget. What are some of the sort of like must-have gadgets you all have been working with in the kitchen?
You know mine. You have to know mine. It's the air fryer. I can't live without it. I don't know what I was doing beforehand. It's really one of those things. And you just start off with the one tray air fryer. Now I've got a two-level air fryer. It's just getting bigger and better. And I love it. So that for me is a kitchen smart must. I mean, you can't go wrong with it.
What are your favorite things to air fry, Rebecca?
Everything, Paul. Everything. There's no end to my air frying. I air fry salmon. I air fry prawns. I air fry chicken wings.
My housemate is a similar proponent of the air fryer. And I was like, what's so good about it? He's like, bro, you literally put anything in it and it comes out as food. And I was like, what are you talking about as an oven? And he was like, yeah, but it's like half the time.
My roast potatoes are no longer oven cooked. They are air fried. And so delicious. Delicious, crispy. So yeah, the air fryer definitely has to be mine. Paul, any kind of smart kitchen appliances that you can't live without?
I mean, I'm a big blender guy. I like my smoothies, my milkshakes. Also, I mean, it's not new appliance, but like I got a slow cooker from a friend of mine, and like that's super useful for someone that like me who's on the go a lot and busy and like, you know, doesn't really have a lot of time for like, you know, meal prep and actually meal creation to the point of delivery. I'm a big Mindful Chef guy. And also some of these like delivery services, they don't have to be super high tech as well. So like I subscribe to one called Gaia Pulses that is literally just this like lovely woman who cooks her, you know, grandmother's recipes from when she grew up in Greece and like has a little cart and like drives them around. I think it's even like a solar powered cart to the point of tech. Drives them around and drops them at your doorstep like the milkman used to do. And it's just like a thermos full of lentils or some really amazing bean stew. And it's like absolutely delicious. I think not all, you know, food tech solutions have to be super high tech. It's just like, hey, here's a Shopify subscription website and I click every week what I want. And, you know, I get delicious hummus and lentil stew and things like that right to my door. And yeah, it's really lovely. So that's some of my favorite food tech.
Yeah, just, you know, connecting that single person to deliver food directly to consumer, like that's so much more efficient. Something I saw recently, almost the exact opposite of food tech, it's something that various folk in Africa have been using for ages, is like, it's basically a slow cooker, but you do it with like polystyrene. So you heat it up once at the start of the day, you put whatever you want in the middle, then you just come back in like 12 hours time and it's slow cooked it for 12 hours. Fucking genius. It's so cool. Yeah, I love stuff like that.
I mean, tech is really important in that interaction. And I think, Paul, when you've just raised about Gaia's Pulses, you kind of forget about the little guy when you have all these options on Deliveroo, etc., etc. So I think that is kind of a nice side to technology impacting the culinary experience. And I think as a person living in Britain in 2023, I am probably like one of 4 in 10 who actually think that the best way to decide whether or not to either visit a restaurant or eat from a small business is actually based on like social media presence or what we get online, which I think is really, really profound as well. Will, I have to ask, how did you find out about Thermometer?
Yep, no, you're completely online. Right. It was a Facebook ad, and whoever built that Facebook ad knew exactly who they were targeting.
Yeah. And Paul, for Gaia's Pulses, how did you actually get hold of that business?
Actually, it was super old school. I was at a co-working space and I literally saw the head of Gaia Pulses like cycling around the little cart that said Gaia Pulses on the side of it, and I just then googled it. So I guess I use SEO to some extent, but it was super like low tech and like just an ad on the side of the bike.
Direct marketing, the old school.
Before we move off of food delivery, one thing I wanted to flag is just some of these stats from the toast piece that we have here. This number 5, like folks in New Mexico, their number one food delivery item is salad. What is going on in New Mexico? Like, are people in New Mexico okay? Like, do we need to send help? Because like, why? Like, I get that it's hot there, but like, why is that their number one food delivery item? I don't understand it. We need to get some New Mexican audience engagement here to figure this out. This is a mystery that needs to be solved. I just wanted to shout that out.
I love that we're like, yeah, we need people to eat healthier, and then as soon as they do, we're like, what's wrong with you?
like really, salad?
Like, make your own. Like, what? Like, are you gonna, like, I feel like when I get salads and food delivery, they're always terrible because they've been underneath all this other hot food and they're wilt. It's just like, that's not where you order salad for. I don't know.
No, I agree with that. I'd say the only fast food chain I've ever had good salad from was in the States, and it was Sweetgreens. Everywhere else,
everyone always talks about Sweetgreens.
Everywhere else you order a salad from, it's just a disappointment.
One thing that jumped out to me from the toast stats here was this number 11, 6 out of 10 adults were more likely to get their food delivered now compared to pre-COVID. And it's even higher, 71% for millennials. Like, I think there's like a shift there that's happening. And we saw this with like Deliveroo, Getir, and like a lot of the companies basically just like profiting wildly from lockdown and things like that. But I think it's like, if you think about your own behavior, it's like kind of fundamentally shifted. I think like how often we stay in and order in versus how often we go out. And like, I think there's like a latent effect kind of COVID, like maybe keeping people in a bit more, keeping them a bit more nested, and, you know, just like, hey, we'll just order in and we're comfortable with staying in a bit more than we used to be.
I definitely would say that I felt that just from my own personal sort of experience, like post-lockdown, I am far more like, yeah, let's just chill and not go out and like, you know, like you still go for big events, but maybe I'm just getting old. But yeah, like I definitely post-lockdown was like borderline agoraphobic for a little bit of just like, I don't want to go to any of these things.
In the dark at home.
No, I'm with my girlfriend. It's not sad. We're staying together.
In the dark at home.
In the dark at home, yeah. With no, the lights are off, but we have Deliveroo.
There's always that game you play where you're like watching Netflix and you're like, how dark can I make it to watch this movie while also eating my food? That's, I don't know if you guys have like dimmers, but I have that, or I'm just like, oh, I can. And it's just, sometimes it's just, yeah, you need just enough light. It's kind of a weird game you play with yourself. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
Last thing to round us off here is like, I do think as well, there's a lot of like cool at home potential innovations in terms of efficiency and optimization. If your shop is being tracked through Ocado, you know, you could very easily get that to the point where you're like, oh, I actually end up throwing away these four items. And not even that complex an algorithm could be like, oh, well, maybe here's what you should order next week on the next weekly shop. So yeah, I think along with the sort of like the food delivery and all the stuff, that the kitchen tech of tomorrow, you know, like a fridge that monitors what you've ordered, when it's gone off, lets you know and pings you a notification. I know this already exists. Pings you a notification on your phone where you're like, hey, by the way, your milk's going to go off next week. Here are four recipes you could use 2 liters of milk to sort of use it all up with. I think that there's some very cool stuff there along with the funner bits of air fryers and stuff where like you could increase the efficiency and decrease the food waste of the kitchen. And I think as well, like, you know, it's a market that's a little underrated. Like, you know, kitchen gadgets in the US alone was $17.6 billion in 2021, expected to reach $19 billion by 2024. So like, there's a real demand and hunger for this, I think, amongst families and households. So it's just, yeah, seeing how the market moves to sort of catch up with it. Can we get Rebecca a digitized air fryer that she can get ready on her phone and cook prawns at any time of day?
Amazing.
It's coming. I mean, that's what's so exciting about that 3D printing. Like, this is, again, I have to make a Star Trek reference, but like, that's a replicator, you know, like 3D printing a food and just saying like, hey, Earl Grey hot, you know, like that's just classic Star Trek replicator vibe. So I love that we're moving into that era now.
Okay, so for the last topic of today's pod, we spoke a little bit about it earlier on in the recording, but we do want to just cover sustainability and food safety. We want to just take a look at the transformative role of technology in promoting sustainable food production, ensuring food safety, and again, kind of addressing global food challenges that have helped construct a more resilient and secure food system. So for the first point, technology is being used to promote sustainable agriculture, which we have spoken about in terms of like the drones going over and having a look at fertile land that could have crops grown on. Also with reducing food waste and enhancing resource efficiency. This is an interesting point because we see here that it's actually estimated that between 21 and 37% of global greenhouse gas emissions actually come from our food system. And that's including how the food is grown, which is an interesting step actually, because I suppose when you think about growing food, you don't always necessarily assume that that would be coming from it.
Yeah, the vast majority of that carbon footprint comes from meat. The practices for how you commercially meat farm are incredibly high emissions. Most of the world's global meat supply comes from Brazil and Argentina, and in the way that they, in Brazil in particular, create that farmland is they cut down huge swathes of rainforest and replace it with cattle grazing land, which, you know, burns a huge amount of CO2 when you burn a slash and burn all the rainforest. Cows, if you didn't know, this is a great stat, they're like the third largest emitter of CO2. They eat grass and then they basically just produce it into massive CO2 farts. So like, I think it's something like volcanoes, industry, and then cows in terms of what's driving climate change. But yeah, and again, like, you know, to where food tech might solve that. I mean, there's increased sustainability, tracking, but then even stuff like lab-grown meat. If you can create, to Paul's replicator vibes, meat that's grown in a lab and only requires an electricity supply to grow it, its carbon footprint will be like literally a thousandth of what something that you carve off a cow is. So yeah, I mean, from like the stuff on the sides of like tracking sustainability, tracking the carbon footprint of individual sort of meat is one, but even just replacing the whole industry at whole scale with stuff like lab-grown meat, I think is a very exciting sector that we're seeing a lot of innovation in.
Yeah, and I think you're starting to see funders get on board with this agenda as well. So example of the venture capital firm Supply Change Capital recently just closed around its first $40 million food fund. It's focused on agricultural technology companies that are committed to sustainability. I think it's really important. Like, you know, you're seeing big companies like General Mills, MassMutual, Bank of America gearing up towards supporting these early stage food and technology companies, getting them involved into, you know, deep technology, supply chain technology, enterprise software that's going to really like shift the agenda forward. So, I mean, it's really good to see funders get involved in the game. One thing that was really positive to see out of that funding decision by Supply Change Capital was the diversity within it. So, you know, they reported that more than 80% of the companies in the portfolio are headed by Latinx, Black, and/or women founders and CEOs. that's super promising. I think you're seeing a lot, especially when it comes to food. Food is so tied to culture and just like, you know, what people's identity is. So more so in food tech than other sectors, it's important for there to be kind of a multicultural lens in terms of how our indigenous communities, how our Black communities, how our South Asian communities, so on and so forth, connecting with their cultural food heritage, but also including tech in that and lifting up some of those cultural practices that I think actually, you know, we have so much to learn from how indigenous communities, for example, in the US, engaged with their own food systems and built food systems before they were colonized. And I think you're seeing kind of a return to that when it comes to food tech of like, okay, there are these deep cultural traditions that are now integrating tech into them. How do we learn from the past, but also learn from these cultures and make sure that we're investing these dollars in the right way so that we're taking those learnings with us into innovation?
In terms of like food and sustainability, there are a lot of actual causes for optimism. It does seem like, to Paul's point, like a kind of movement away from this kind of wasteful system that we've accepted for so long. And also, like, you know, brands that you would not expect really taking it seriously, like Unilever have a pledge to be carbon neutral by 2030, and by all accounts from major climate change charities really are genuinely like that, you know, they're putting their money where their mouth is. They aren't greenwashing the problem. There does just seem to be this sort of like, you know, for the first time I was in a restaurant the other day and it said, we don't serve avocados these months because when we do, we've imported them, they have a huge carbon footprint and we might as well be selling you steak. And, you know, like there's just that growing realization and awareness and being backed with a lot of very cool tech and, yeah, a return to sort of like, you know, pre sort of colonization practices, and then also just a lens on those sort of like capitalist industrial complexes of, if you want to be operational in this market and be accepted by consumers, you do have to care about this stuff and really make a genuine effort to be better, be less wasteful and be more carbon neutral.
Related to that too, when we talk about food safety and labeling, I just saw this like really damning report from The Guardian about how a huge number of UK vegan products are found to contain milk or eggs. So I think, you know, they basically looked at 24 foods labeled vegan that contain animal products. And then, you know, they found traces of egg and milk in an array of goods that were labeled as vegan or plant-based. So what this article talked about is there's basically no legal definition for vegan food, which gives firms like a pretty wide berth to market their products as being vegan, even if they contain dairy or eggs. And also it revealed there's no threshold requirement for animal derived products in the UK or the EU, which is different from what we see for products like gluten, where folks have like real, you know, sort of dietary intolerances or even, you know, being allergic to it, for example. So I think there's like a real opportunity here for food tech to get in there and sort of like, how do we in a deep technical way verify that food is truly vegan or truly vegetarian and analyze that, give those tools to the consumer to say, hey, you actually are in more control over how these foods. Obviously, it starts with like policy and you know, sort of the government actually coming to a legal definition of what vegan food means, and then putting in place the opportunities for companies to say, okay, we're going to heed this legal definition and we're going to use food tech to make sure that we're doing so. I think that's a really interesting opportunity. But yeah, I mean, really scary report here about, you know, people who are going through their lives thinking that they're adhering to a vegan or vegetarian diet, and then they're eating some of these more processed foods, obviously, that are just, you know, chock full of non-vegetarian, non-vegan products. I think it's a real opportunity for food tech to step in and help the game here.
Yeah, and we talk a bit with Alex, one the guest we have on later, about this, but like that real registration of like, this is what's in the product through something like blockchain can really eliminate a lot of these kind of issues. And the problem with those sort of products is quite often they're like, oh, well, we didn't know that, someone must have done it at the factory level. Whereas if, you know, you have a step-by-step registration process on something that's immutable like the blockchain, suddenly you can escape this world. You know, like the example Alex gave was like the Findus lasagna scandal that rocked the UK for a while, maybe 10 years ago, where it turned out a lot of products had horse meat in it rather than cow meat and were being sold as beef burgers. You know, stuff like that is more commonplace than you think. And yeah, that sort of desire to regulate and then the technology to back it up, I think, are super important and something there is more of a growing call for. I think vegan products generally as well, like even the stuff that are pure vegan, quite often it has a higher carbon footprint than many meat alternatives, and you know, they don't talk about that. And I found this when I was a vegan, I had to really almost become a PhD in what was genuine sort of like carbon negative products that made the world a better place and what wasn't. And it was a large part of the reason I gave up on the fucking end, to be honest. It was just like,
like I have so much of the emphasis is on me, like literally researching every element of this brand before I buy anything from it. And it's like, I feel like a private detective. Like I just want to make a fucking, you know, shakshuka with a vegan alternative. And it turns out if I use this particular product, seitan, I might as well have just fill it full of bacon. So yeah, I think the standards and regulations section of it, I think is crying out for tech solutions.
So as we close out here, we want to just shout out, we you know, ran out of time in this great episode, but there's a few examples of food technologies that are being used currently to curb climate change. One of them is biomimicry. So you've probably, you know, familiar with architectural examples of biomimicry, like Beijing National Stadium, which is designed to mimic the insulation of a bird's nest, or even the Eiffel Tower, which is modeled after a human femur. But basically, you know, taking these things that we see in nature and trying to redevelop them to positively impact our food system. We see this technology you know, increasingly used to develop climate smart technologies in food and agriculture. Regenerative agriculture is an example of biomimicry in technology and farming. There's a company in LA called BeeFlow. They've studied the key drivers of pollination, including like the chemical signals between bees and flowers that make pollination more successful. And so the company sells, you know, bee feedstock products for key crops like avocados, strawberries, almonds, some of your favorites. I think highlighting some of these solutions that are cropping up to sort of help improve the food tech system and also combat climate change is really important as we leave you today.
Yeah, and some other cool ones of high protein food sources that are created at low carbon footprint, from mushrooms and fungus to sort of create this, like, you know, superfoods that can feed a large amount of people for very little carbon electricity expenditure. So yeah, I wanted to end on a positive note. There's a lot of very cool stuff going on out there, and a lot of very smart people genuinely trying to solve the problems that we're facing in the world.
I think too, this stat jumped out to me that, like, you know, giving people a more diverse palate. So, you know, the stat in the Forbes piece is that 75% of our diets consist of just 12 plants and 5 animal species. That'll be a great creative that we could do for this podcast, by the way. But yeah, think about things like soy, maize, wheat, beef. You know, they've historically provided humankind with a lot of cheap calories, resulting in some of the lowest hunger rates that we've seen in history. But hunger's on the rise, and we're now seeing the dominance of this, like, monoculture that's kind of driving some of our health and planetary crises. So I think diversifying our food sources is a critical step here in terms of feeding the planet. And I think some of the food tech that you're seeing, like the fungi stuff, and even the use of insects and things like that, is really helping us to diversify our palate and have a more sustainable food future.
If you're the listener, educate yourself, have a look at where this stuff comes from, and you know, order the stuff that's low footprint and highly ethical, fair trade, and sustainable.
And if you want to make it taste good, just air fry it.
Yeah, if you want to taste, if it tastes good, just fucking buy an air fryer, man. Buy an air fryer and put some fucking crickets in there. It's gonna be fine. Before we move on to our interview, make sure you like and subscribe and follow the podcast.
And up next, we've got Alex Bond, CEO of Fresh Check, to talk about what they're doing with improving the food hygiene system.
Hello, everybody. Very excited to introduce our guest for today's podcast. I'm joined by Alex Bond, CEO and co-founder at Fresh Check. Thank you so much and welcome to the pod.
Well, thank you very much for having me along. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. We're doing a pod all about food tech and the cool stuff going on in space. And so we wanted to get you on and have a bit of a chat about Fresh Check and what you're up to.
Fantastic. Thank you. It's, you know, we're one of the more niche sides of the business. But yeah, always happy to talk about the food industry and what our perspective is of what's going on.
So yeah, for those of our listeners unaware, could you give us a bit of an intro to yourself and a bit of an overview of Fresh Check, you know, what its mission is and the specific ways that, you know, you're bringing a tech focus to the food industry. And I know what you do is not just confined to the food industry, but just to industries generally large.
Yeah, of course. So what we do at FreshCheck is we develop color change tools to detect contamination. So contamination affects all of us, bacterial contamination, viral contamination, all sorts of things. And we want to be able to make that visible because, of course, bacteria are invisible. Viruses too, but they're much harder to detect, so we don't detect them. But what we do within the food industry is we help them confirm that they're cleaning practices are working. So we all know that we have to clean. That's fairly standard. We all do that at home. Well, so, some of us do that at home, not all of us.
I feel very seen in a way that I don't like.
I was gonna say, I was like, I need to pedal back there. Yeah. but obviously in the food industry, the cleaning is quite tightly regimented. People have to make sure that their cleaning is up to standard. And what we try and offer is a way to monitor whether that cleaning is working. And if it's not working, find ways to implement new cleaning procedures or new testing so that you can identify the problem, remove it, and hopefully prevent the spread of foodborne disease, but also just to help reduce food waste and make sure that everyone is working in a high quality and safe environment.
So how does it actually work in terms of detecting this sort of contamination?
That's a great question. So what we have is a dye attached to an iron atom. It's an iron ion technically, but it's easier to say iron atom. And when the iron are attached, the solution is purple, but bacteria give off a molecule which grabs the iron away. And when the iron is removed, the dye becomes a yellow color. And so usually that results in a green colour in the middle, but we also have a separate result for if there's excess cleaning chemical. So for some people, that's great. They want to know that there's an excess cleaning chemical keeping them safe. But for some people, there's a risk of taint that might, if you're preparing a sandwich, that might cause issues down the road. So you don't want it tasting of soap. So you have to make sure you've done a rinse step. So yeah, that's it. I actually have some with me if you'd like to test the cleanliness of the
the podcast studio. I would be terrified of what we would find.
Can save that for later then.
I mean, like, Rebecca, a wonderful social media manager and co-host, is currently recording this. While you're recording it, maybe just think of some cool stuff that we could test for contamination in this room. That's really cool. Like, I love that. That's so cool. It's it's an ion, and like just that one separation changes the whole color of the solution.
Yeah, that's it in its simplest form. There's obviously a few extra little bells and whistles on top of it than that, but yeah, that is it at its core. So what we try to do is make it color change so that it's visible to the human eye. The other technologies out there at the moment all require a reader or a handset, so that handset costs about £1,000, and obviously that limits adoption across every other industry and obviously has a cost effect as well. So we knew we wanted to stick in the visible spectrum so that it would be a tool that could be used by anyone, so that hygiene testing and awareness could be ubiquitous rather than just for the biggest food manufacturers.
Is it just the food industry or any other applications that you guys use for?
Contamination is a problem everywhere. I said that already, but obviously healthcare is the really big one. Antimicrobial resistance is huge. We're running out of antibiotics, so the ability to produce them is much slower than bacteria can become resistant to them. So rather than dealing with people getting antibiotic resistant strains of bacteria, MRSA, whatever it might be, it's easier to remove the problem in the first place. So look for a preventive measure. And if you clean your hospital ward or your tertiary healthcare procedure or even your hospital canteens, it removes that cross-contamination of bacteria, which are very hard to get rid of, as opposed to, say, viruses, and it stops that spread altogether so that we don't have as big a problem with antibiotic resistance.
And I'm imagining COVID and the far higher focus that we now have as a society on contamination, on spread of disease, must have, like, it in a sort of unpleasant, but at least fortuitous for you way, been quite a boon to your sort of the awareness of the need for your product and its demand.
I think it's reminded as how important preventive measures are. Whether it's cleaning, whether it's putting masks on, whatever your preventive measure might be, it's reinforced the fact that they existed. Now, I'm not going to speculate where the virus came from, whether it was a meat market or a lab or otherwise. Either way, there was obviously a contamination risk there where things weren't being controlled, people weren't aware of the contamination risks. And so if we'd been able to prevent that leak in the first place by identifying issues with the cleaning procedures, then we could have prevented it in the first place. And we can see the trillions of dollars that have been spent trying to combat something once it's been released. On the flip side of that, no one has any money because everyone spent all their money doing stuff. So we have found it quite difficult to convince people that it's still worth investing in preventive measures. I think there's a little psychology where you go, it's already happened, the worst has happened, so we'll be fine for another 100 years and we get the Spanish flu III, but hopefully not.
My girlfriend's a film director and she was literally working on a documentary about how we were due for another pandemic about a year before the pandemic happened, and then like the studio was like, this is stupid, it won't happen, we're not going to carry on with the documentary. So talk to me about the development of the product and your sort of like journey. How did it start? What's your background? What's your co-founder's background? How have we ended up at Fresh Checks as it is today?
So we went through quite a few different journeys. We've been going since 2015, so we're quite long in the tooth for tech startups, I suppose, that haven't made huge amounts of money or folded. But my co-founder and I were both PhD students at Imperial. We were studying chemical biology of health and disease, so sort of the underpinning science came from there. And originally, what we wanted to do was create a use-by label. So the use-by label would sit on food, it would change colour with bacterial contamination and warn you your chicken has gone off, or say, hey, actually, you've got another day. We don't need to cause that food waste. So that was our initial starting off point, before we realized that certainly in 2016, food manufacturers didn't want to invest in a product that didn't have a clear value add. it was good for the consumers, but they had to pay and that cut their costs. And obviously the food industry is quite brutal about its profit margins. But during that procedure, we had developed the technology. We had this color change patch, which would react to bacteria. And we thought, okay, there's other areas of contamination where they are spending money. So let's see if we can do something there. We then developed a spray, which we launched on the market in 2018. A spray is great. You have a lovely black table here in the middle of the podcast studio. And a colour change spray on a black surface is impossible to see. And so across the food industry, we found that people needed something which would remove the background. And we also needed to make sure that it was easier to record the result. So we went away from this, from people saying, we don't like the spray, we have to clean it up, we don't have a way to record the result. And we said, right, we're going to redevelop the core technology into a swab. We're going to make it so that it's more bacteria specific, so it's not picking up cleaning chemicals. And we're also going to couple it with a complete tech system. So rather than being a commodity product, we needed to couple it with a system which would record results, it would track hygiene, it would warn you about areas of concern, so that you can not only see your hygiene data, provide record of due diligence to auditing bodies and insurance bodies, but also for your own peace of mind, be able to say, look, here, we have this record, we know what's gone on.
That's really cool. I worked in the hospitality industry for like a decade and various other random jobs before that. And it is, you know, incredible how behind the times a lot of systems are. So to be bringing that tech and data sort of element to back up a very cool physical product is unique and very needed.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because in the industry, it's so difficult. People don't want to adopt new techniques. It's a very fast-moving industry. Food is always going. And if you've worked in the hospitality industry, you know how many covers you have to do, how much you have to clean, of whatever it might be. Like, you're always going. And so it's very hard to find the time to implement a new technique. And so what we wanted to do was make it color change so that if you want, you can use pen and paper. That's fine. That's your choice. But hey, if you download the handy app, then it's all right there for you. It's ready to go.
That is quite a very tech-led approach to an industry that is a little technophobic. You know, what else have you been seeing sort of in the space in terms of interesting kind of like innovations in the space? Like, but you know, because it does feel like there's so much of it that hasn't really changed since almost the Victorian era. So there's a lot of like fertile ground there for someone to come in with like smart tech and solve problems. Have you seen any other cool innovations or brands or startups in the space that you really, really appreciate?
I'll be honest, I think that, like you say, it is devoid of a lot of tech development, certainly in the bulk of it. So in food manufacturing, there is only so much you can do. You grow the food, you process the food, you sell the food. That at the moment requires human hands. I think you talked in an earlier podcast about we can automate that, we can make that AI, but that's actually quite hard to do. I remember seeing a startup that wanted to make a robot to pick strawberries and they failed because the robot couldn't manipulate the strawberry to see if it was right. And it was always just cheaper to use human labor. So it's a really hard industry to innovate in some senses, but in some instances, there's a lot going on. So there's a company called Mimica. They were competitors of ours once when we were developing the food label, but they've developed a bump mark, which as the food degrades, it becomes bumpy. It was originally developed to help blind people who don't have access to, or people who are nearsighted or otherwise visually impaired is the word I'm looking for, to identify that food had spoiled. And they've been working on some really cool things which avoid some of the value add issues that we had. And there's also been exciting developments in the tech area just in terms of allergens and awareness and making sure that information is out there on your receipts, tracking those sorts of things. But I think there's so much more that people can do, and I can't pinpoint that exactly because I'm so tunnel vision onto hygiene testing, but there's a lot coming. You guys might know more about the industry.
This is always the problem with the food industry, is like you approach the big fish and there's only like 10 of them, and they're just like, no, fuck you, show me how this is going to make us money or go to hell. But there does seem to be a growing movement of people caring about, you know, the sustainability of their food, the being able to track it, fair trade, all of those things. And I would have thought something like the Co-op, M&S would be interested in working into their wider values of like, we are helping you eliminate food waste because we don't give you a Best Buy date, we give you a thing on your milk, and if your milk's off, it you will fucking know because your milk will go purple, yeah. or whatever it, yeah, might be. So yeah, I do think that maybe you're ahead of your time.
Well, that's it. Yeah, we look back and we think, hey, maybe 4 years later we would have been right at the we would have been at exactly the right time, but no, we're not there now. Although you did mention some of those companies, not even the big companies, but Morrison's are great. They're doing a lot. They have lots of local manufacturers as well. Greggs are fantastic. Their focus on renewable plastics. You guys might have heard of Nopla, which is a plastic replacement company. They're working with Just Eat to create new plastics that go around that will have your ketchup sachet or whatever it might be.
Something I've seen that is quite interesting in the tech space in terms of innovation is actually using blockchain to register in, because like you can't really, I mean, don't fucking at me, blockchain enthusiasts. It's very, very difficult to manipulate data once it's on the blockchain. So like they do that for like some of the stuff you're talking about, of like registering that a check was made. They do that for like carbon credit, sustainability, where it was sourced. And I've met some guys basically looking to try and build the Amazon of Italian food delicatessens, like an e-commerce platform for delicatessen food. But you could see the journey from literally from farm to table in a way that was totally unfuckable with, because it was hosted on the blockchain. So there's some cool people doing some cool space, but it is, you know, 4 or 5 person startups on the fringe. It's never like, yeah, Unilever have invested in X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, they are starting to develop. So Barilla have got some startup competitions. There are a few other places. A few of the big food manufacturers are starting to wise up to the fact that there are things out there. They're sort of behind the curve. You look at 20 years ago in the pharmaceutical industry, and that's perhaps what they were starting to do, saying, hey, look, there are startups out there. Maybe we invest in that rather than keeping R&D internally. And food obviously doesn't necessarily do much R&D or development of any technology, but yeah, so that's starting to get there. But you're right, blockchain is, I think it's one of the, it's hard to find the solution for blockchain. Where does it go? This amazing technology, but the supply chain proof is one of them, and making sure that we don't have horse meat in our burgers. That sounds like nothing, but 5 years ago that was the hot topic. It was, how do we prove we don't have horse meat in our burgers? So what are we going to do going forward? But we're starting to get there.
No, yeah, and just to kind of give a like a, you know, an idea of the scope of the issue that Alex and tech folk like him face in this sector. One of our clients is a brand called Pepper. They've just built Shopify, but they built it specifically for massive food wholesalers. So if you want to order like 60,000 hams, you would normally do that by just picking up a phone, calling your ham guy, and then like everything is done via paper and receipts. And you know, it's just mad. Pepper have invented this brilliant e-commerce platform, but it really is just like, we invented this 20 years ago. It's just, it's only now filtering into the food system. Like, you know, this is not new tech, but for everyone who uses it, they're like, oh my God, how have I ever worked without this? But that's what innovation is within big food.
When for us, our customers, it's still always on the phone. It's always a phone call. We'll send them videos. We'll send them how to do's. We'll provide it in a PDF, whatever format they like. But it will always ultimately come down to chatting to them on the phone. So eventually, hopefully, Pepper will lead the way. Shout out to Pepper, I suppose. but yeah, people are slowly shifting. And we've seen actually as the hygiene managers start to get a bit younger in the food industry, even their approaches are starting to change, and they're starting to question what we've had as established procedures for the past 30 years and say, isn't there maybe a smarter way we can do this?
Yeah, it's always the first question I ask some of our clients when we're in like the discovery phase. And I'm well aware I'm going to be one in 30 years time, so you know, this is no shade to them, but I'm always like, out of 10, how many meetings do you have that are with a 60-year-old white man? And if it's always 8 or above, I'm like, okay, we're not doing a digital marketing strategy, we're doing a fucking mailing strategy, because that's what those people respond to. You don't need a dank TikTok account, my friend. You need email and fucking Facebook, maybe.
You should see our memes, though. They're great. They don't get any likes. It's all useless, but
it's just entertaining your social media manager. No one else is enjoying that. The best kind of meme. If a meme is posted in a forest, does anyone really enjoy it? Talking of sort of like the, you know, the cutting edge tech of the time, obviously everyone's losing their shit over AI at the moment. Have you seen any interesting applications of AI in the food space or just, you know, the wider sector you operate within?
Again, it's so slow moving. I don't want to say that same answer again, but I think probably what's best is to give our example of what we think AI will do going forward. And I think for us, we can refine cleaning procedures. We can help people say, hey, here's area of risk. One, we don't want people to be over cleaning. That's as bad as under cleaning, because it creates waste, it creates labor. People have a short 8 hours with which to do their shift, and if you can save 20 minutes and say, don't clean there, do clean there, and then revise that going forward and provide that information to them in a way that they can understand, whether it's printed, whether it's on an app that they understand, however it is. And obviously there are language barriers. The food industry is an interesting area regardless. But for us, AI is really interesting in terms of learning those new procedures and implementing them. And we can pick up whether or not it's working to refine our own AI system. And even the fact that we want to do visual interpretation, at the moment we just use by eye, but there's obviously huge scope for training AI models to identify, depending on lighting, camera type, all of the sorts of different issues that we have, whether or not the colour change has occurred and to what degree, so that we can provide an objective version of our test rather than the current subjective version. So for us, there's lots of opportunity in AI in terms of refining those systems which aren't currently being refined. We have a flow chart which we provide to our customers, but that's about as nuanced as it is at the moment.
And to that specific problem of the fact that your KP team are almost always not English speaking as the first language, you know, being able to just use a large language model to generate recommendations in almost any language without having to actually code that in is, you know, a godsend.
Yeah. Although the translation of swab tip is quite different depending on where you're trying to get to.
Hey, whoever, any data scientists out there that have a solution for that swab tip problem. And then maybe just moving us over to like your more personal journey, like, you know, as a founder, how's that been going from PhD student to starting a business, you know, real focus on science and like a love of the academia to it, to trying to find a viable business model? They're very different and very unpleasant sort of skills in many people's journeys. Like, how have you found that?
Yeah, so we're getting deep now. So I didn't finish my PhD. So I should have finished in 2018, but I didn't finish. The mental health toll of trying to complete my PhD was just too much. I was also trying to focus on the startup. In 2018, we had our first funding. So by that time, I was full time. So I was focused on it completely. And, you know, it takes a huge toll. It's fascinating. My core drive for academia and for entrepreneurship was I like to create things. I like to find solutions with the scientific backing that can solve problems. And entrepreneurship offered me a route to see that happen in real life, interact with people, get people's feedback, and use that feedback to make something better. Sometimes be a little defensive about it, learn how not to be defensive about it, and go through that. But it's also incredibly stressful having employees, having people who are looking to us in terms of, even in terms of our product offering. If we let people down, this is a operation critical procedure, so people need to have their stock on hand, and that's very stressful. It's very, very difficult. And as someone who is perhaps a little bit more left-leaning than some startup founders, or perhaps not, I don't know, you'll know the demographics better than me, I find it difficult that I work principally to generate value. Obviously, there's a huge amount that I'm doing for the world, but if you sort of take me back to my core as a CEO in that role, I'm there to generate shareholders' cash, I'm there to save our customers money, I'm there to provide value for people. And that's not necessarily my personal outlook on life. And that's something I've had to wrestle with and come to terms with. But I have come to terms with it, and I am happy doing it, and I do enjoy doing it. But it certainly was I don't know, we don't often talk about founder mental health, but that was one of the big blocks for me as I learned, hey, I'm going to be okay in this industry doing what I like doing as soon as I've found my boundaries and where I'm happy at.
Yeah, it's always the first piece of advice I give anyone who's looking to sort of start branching out. I was like, I hope you have a therapist. I don't say it as a joke, like I have a therapist, I see him every week. I don't think I'd have made it through, I'd have 100% burnt out without it. There's so much of it that you don't prepare yourself for. Like, you just think, oh, I'm going to start a company, it'll be great, it'll be so much fun, I'll just get to do the stuff I want to. And sometimes you do, but the vast majority of it, it's compromises, it's very scary things that you would just never have thought of. Like, this person's career and personal development and livelihood rests solely on me now. It's different but the same in terms of, like, you know, for our clients, like, they bring you on, we need you to grow this product, this is my dream, I'm a founder of a tech startup, I've spent 5 years putting this together, you know, kind of similar to your story. And it's like, if the go-to-market strategy doesn't work, then we've just burnt the VC funding we have and we're fucked. And it's like, it is a lot of pressure, because, like, you know, like, some agencies don't give a shit, but we're, like, you know, really invested in whether our clients work succeed or not. So it's very scary when you're like, these guys have given us 60K. I know it's the only money they have for marketing this year, and we're probably the difference between success or not, or at least growth or not.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, the pressure comes from everywhere. And in every startup, you'll hear the same. You don't know what the pressure point is going to be, but we all find somewhere along the line we've had to make a compromise, but we all have to work to succeed. That's it, there is nothing else. It's the most success driven industry out there, being a startup.
No, yeah, and so, and I think you come to realize, like, at least for me personally, I was like, okay, you had a bit of a naive view of what this would be, and you can still do some of that. It's just it's 30% of the time. It's not 100% of the time. You can do that stuff that brings you joy and you think makes the world a better place. You just have to do a lot of this other stuff that makes the business work.
Yeah, exactly.
Got a little deep there on our check on food tech. But just last question to round us out here. What are your sort of future plans for Fresh Check? Speaking to that kind of combination of like what makes business sense and what makes sense for you and your mission and your values. Like, yeah, what are you hoping the sort of next 5 years looks like for you all?
I think the next 5 years are exciting. We're principally an IP-driven company. The technology we've developed is where the core of our IP is, and we've been working very hard in the lab to develop new techniques. So at the moment we have a swab, but it's single-use plastics, and that's not really what we want, obviously. Although it's fully recyclable and improvement over the existing, our drive is always to go to fully renewable, carbon negative if possible, as a solution. And so we've got some really exciting developments that the lab team have been working on. So shout out to them because they do the hard work. There's a lot of exciting things which I unfortunately can't talk about. Yeah, but in the next 5 years, we're going to have some very fun products out there which are more consumer focused, which are more healthcare focused, and which can hopefully stem the spread of infection at lots of different areas. So that's our goal, is to prove the value there, but also actually make a real change and hopefully prevent some people from getting ill.
100%. Well, I mean, I think that's a great place to end on, and a really worthy goal. And yeah, we'll be cheerleading from the sides.
Thank you very much.
Alex Bond, CEO and co-founder of Fresh Check. Thank you so much for joining us today. And if anyone wants to check out some of the memes that are currently being underappreciated, learn more about the product, where can they find you?
Freshcheck.co.uk is the best place, but you'll also find us on LinkedIn. And as you said, it's very much not a tech-driven industry, so you can pick up the phone and give us a call as well.
Pick up a phone, give them a call. We've not had that as a call to action yet. Yeah, we'll put the phone number in the episode description. If you want to have a chat with Alex, just pick up the phone.
That's great. I'm going to go and talk to my therapist. Yeah.